Liang had the ships parade back and forth in front of Cao Cao's men, who just kept peppering them with arrows, and the arrows would stick in the hay bales. When one side of the ships completely bristled with arrows, he had them turn to present the other side. Finally, Liang shouted out, "Thanks for all the arrows," and he withdrew. And so he fulfilled his vow by providing 100,000 arrows by tricking Cao Cao into supplying them. Now, while this is a wonderful story, it's been featured in a number of movies and in other sorts of media, it is probably a later invention. Although there does seem to have been an incident where Cao Cao's forces fired upon a southern ship, which may have served as the inspiration for the whole tale. Because the northerners were suffering from seasickness, Cao Cao ordered that his ships were to be tied together several rows deep, and this effectively created one single enormous floating raft out of all of his vessels. This act may have alleviated the seasickness by creating a more stable platform, but it also rendered his fleet nearly immobile, and it made it incapable of any sort of maneuvering. This was a fatal error, and it perhaps reveals Cao Cao's inexperience at riverine warfare. Fastened together in that manner, the fleet was anchored beneath some red cliffs, and that geographical feature inspired the name by which the battle has become known. By the way, the exact site of those cliffs remains a matter of hot scholarly dispute. The southern allies, seeing an opportunity with this particular deployment, determined to attack the tempting target using fire ships. One of the allied naval commanders pretended that he was planning to defect, along with his whole squadron, over to Cao Cao's side. And so he sent a message to Cao Cao declaring this intention. Cao Cao replied, told him to bring his ships over and join them to his fleet. This was another misstep. Cao Cao should have ordered the purported traitor to surrender his vessels at some neutral location, rather than letting them get close to his own ships. The supposedly defecting boats were in reality loaded with flammable materials, such as dry straw soaked in oil. And so they set off under full sail for Cao Cao's tethered raft of ships. A propitious wind propelled them towards the gathered mass. Too late, Cao Cao became suspicious of this squadron speeding towards him. But, tied together as they were, his warships were unable to take any evasive action to avoid the oncoming vessels. According to plan, the crews aboard the fireships ignited their combustible cargoes, and the flaming ships plunged right into the helpless mass of Cao Cao's fleet. The fire spread rapidly throughout the wooden vessels, and hundreds of ships were engulfed in the subsequent conflagration. Meanwhile, the other ships of the Southern Coalition swarmed forward, attacked, unleashing flights of arrows, and adding to the confusion on the northern side. Although Cao Cao still had a large, intact army on the shore, this sudden, unexpected destruction of his fleet seems to have completely unnerved both Cao Cao and his soldiers. Cao Cao himself escaped the conflagration on the waves, and making it to shore, just took off and fled northwards. In the aftermath, his dismayed army fell apart, with contingents breaking away and scattering all across the landscape. Many of these became densely packed, trying to escape along the one main road, and so the jubilant southerners just sliced into the panicky throng, inflicting massive casualties. Others decided to take their chances fleeing across the swampy ground, but this didn't work out very well either. They got bogged down in a nightmare of mud and likewise were slaughtered. The retreat had degenerated into a calamitous rout. Cao Cao's few surviving ships that weren't burned were just beached by their crews and abandoned. This was a complete and thorough defeat. Cao Cao's enemies celebrated that the mighty warlord had been brought low. Clearly stung by the thought that his previously lofty reputation as a general would be damaged by the disaster at Red Cliffs, Cao Cao circulated his own version of events. He issued a decree that justified the outcome as simply being a wise tactical withdrawal. He stated, "During the Red Cliffs campaign, my men were taken ill, so I burned my ships and withdrew." While Cao Cao was subsequently the victim of hostile chroniclers, this was clearly a significant setback. From that time on, he was forced to shift his attention to consolidating his hold on the north, and basically had to abandon his ambitions of conquering the south and uniting all of China. That dream had quite literally gone up in flames on the waters beneath the Red Cliffs. The Battle of Red Cliffs was a pivotal event in Chinese history because it ensured that most of the next century would be taken up by violent civil wars. It's a little bit of a puzzle how such a previously competent, even gifted commander could have blundered so badly in this battle. Cao Cao's actions violate a number of the dicta in his own writings and in those of Sun Tzu. Cao Cao was uncharacteristically taken in by really an obvious ploy when the southern squadron commander pretended to defect so as to get his fireships within deadly range of Cao Cao's armada. And the very fact that it was an incendiary attack should not have thrown him, because he himself had earlier successfully used exactly these sort of tactics when he burned the supply train of his enemy in the Guandu campaign. The relative inexperience of Cao Cao and his men at naval warfare, along with the unfavorable marshy terrain, fatigue from the long march, the effects of disease, all may have contributed to this crushing defeat. Overall, the battle illustrates that even for a good leader, it's difficult to always make the right decisions, and that such lapses can have dire consequences. Cao Cao ruled the north for more than a decade after Red Cliffs, and he was succeeded by his son, who became the first emperor of the Wei dynasty. Sun Quan lived even longer, reigning for another 30 years, and he was also succeeded by his son. Liu Bei consolidated his rule over his provinces and proclaimed himself an emperor. As both sides had anticipated, his alliance with Sun Quan proved temporary, and the two were at war with one another within a decade after Red Cliffs. Liu Bei died shortly afterwards. On his deathbed, Liu Bei named his longtime advisor, strategist Liang, to act as regent until his young son came of age. The crafty Liang then reestablished the alliance with Sun Quan and served as regent until his death in 234. In closing, it's worth mentioning that the Battle of Red Cliffs is important not just for its effects on history, but also for its influence and fame in later Chinese culture. Fictionalized accounts of it have served as the inspiration for innumerable works of literature, poetry, and film. And certainly the most eminent of all these is that it forms the central episode of the great multi-volume historical novel, The Romance of the Three Kingdoms, that was written in the 14th century. This work is regarded as one of the four great classical novels of Chinese literature, and it's among the most widely read and popular of all Chinese books. Even today, the battle continues to exert a strong fascination upon both artists and the Chinese public. For example, in 2008, it was the subject of a sumptuous four-hour film made by acclaimed director John Woo called Red Cliffs. This cinematic epic was the most expensive Chinese production ever produced up to that point, and it was an enormous success in China, breaking all previous box office records in that country. Thank you.
Lecture 5, Barbarian Gate, Adrianople, and Pliska.
Although the two battles in this lecture took place more than 400 years apart in time, they share a number of striking similarities. Both pitted armies of the Eastern Roman, later termed the Byzantine Empire, against a tribe of barbarians from the north. In each case, these barbarians had initially sought refuge within the Roman Empire, but after being rejected or even mistreated, they turned against it. In both eras, the campaign began promisingly for the Romans, with some minor initial successes. But these then made the emperors overconfident and careless. Such attitudes resulted in the two emperors leading their respective armies into perilous situations. And finally, each battle was a complete disaster for the Romans, ending not merely with the near total destruction of the armies, but with the deaths of the emperors themselves on the battlefield. By far the more famous of these two military mishaps is the first one, the Battle of Adrianople. This took place in AD 378. The Roman emperor who met his fate at Adrianople was Valens, and his opponents were a confederation of Gothic tribes. Over the previous three centuries prior to Adrianople, the Roman Empire had undergone a dramatic series of ups and downs. From the golden age of the 2nd century AD, Rome descended into the chaos of the early and mid 3rd century, when civil wars, barbarian invasions, and economic collapse brought the empire to the brink of dissolution. During the late 3rd century, however, a remarkable succession of practical soldier emperors drove off the barbarians and stabilized the empire. The long-standing tendency of the empire to split into eastern and western halves had become formalized, so that each section, each half, now had its own emperor and capital city. And although those two halves often collaborated, and the emperors were frequently linked by marriages, they were still separate empires. By the late 4th century, the Roman-ruled world had settled into a relatively stable condition. And if it was not the all-powerful empire that it had once seemed to be, it was still a potent one. Rome's greatest rival was an eastern successor state to the Parthian Empire known as the Sasanians. The Sasanians occupied roughly the same territory as the earlier Parthian and Persian empires. In addition, numerous so-called barbarian tribes, nations, and confederations lined the borders of the eastern and western empires. The Romans had a complicated relationship with these groups. At various moments, individual tribes might be enemies, friends, or allies with either or both of the Roman empires. One trend over this period, though, that is consistent was that the Romans increasingly recruited troops for their legions from these barbarian nations, as well as incorporating entire barbarian contingents into their army as auxiliaries. In 378, Valens was the emperor of the Eastern Roman Empire. At the time of the battle, he had already been on the throne for 14 years, and he was about 50 years old. The one surviving physical description that we have of him is not overly flattering. It says that he was of average height, had bowed legs, a protruding stomach, and a bad eye. Nevertheless, he had proven himself a solid commander, who had directed several successful campaigns, and he was a conscientious administrator, who erected a number of important public works. Among these was a nice new aqueduct for the eastern capital, Constantinople. He was said to be a strict disciplinarian, and he was an enemy of corrupt officials, although he himself was a bit prone to laziness. The emperor of the Western Roman Empire was Valens' nephew, Gratian. Despite his youth, Gratian had already won military laurels. He led a campaign against the Alemanni, that's a tribe against the along the Rhine frontier. The fulsome praise that he received for that deed was said to have annoyed his uncle, Valens, who thought it was too much, that it was excessive for such a young man. And this aroused the older man's jealousy. The origins of the people we refer to as the Goths are disputed. The Goths were composed of a number of rather loosely related tribes. Their own legends claim that they initially migrated from Scandinavia. Their language is classified by linguists as being part of the Germanic branch of the Indo-European language tree. Wherever they actually originated, in the centuries before Adrianople, they had become migratory and eventually occupied a ill-defined territory that stretched from the Danube down towards the Crimean. To further complicate matters, historians have often labeled the two main Gothic groups who participated in the Battle of Adrianople as the Ostrogoths and the Visigoths. This is what you'll see in many textbooks. But while the Goths at Adrianople were the ancestors of those later groups, at the time of the battle, they are more properly termed the Tervingi and the Greothungi. The most important Gothic chieftain was Fritigern, who seems to have been an able general and an inspirational leader. What brought the Goths into conflict with Rome was the actions of yet another barbarian group, the Huns. The Huns have enjoyed a reputation all the way from antiquity up until today of being one of, if not the fiercest and most savage of all the barbarian groups. And there is an element of truth in this. The Huns were true nomads who roamed the Central Asian steppe, and they were absolutely outstanding horsemen and archers. They were much feared for the ferocity of their raids. The Huns began to migrate westwards, and they moved into the territory of another group, the Alans. After defeating the Alans and actually incorporating many of them into their armies was their practice, the Huns moved yet further westward, encroaching on the lands of the Gothic Greothungi. They, in turn, were defeated, with many fleeing eastward ahead of the Huns. The next Gothic group to be menaced by the Huns was the Tervingi. And when they, too, were unable to cope with the Huns, they sent a request to the Roman Emperor Valens, seeking permission to cross the Danube, which was the border, and to take refuge within Roman territory. A sense of the terror inspired by the Huns' advance can be observed in the words of a Roman historian, who stated, "An unknown race appeared from some remote corner of the earth, uprooting and destroying everything in their path, like a tempest descending from the mountains." While there had been some intermittent skirmishing between Rome and the Goths over the previous century, there had also been diplomacy and cooperation. And when the Tervingi petition was made in 376, there was actually a formal peace treaty in effect. And under the terms of this treaty, the Goths were likely providing troops to serve in the Roman army. Valens granted the Goths' request for asylum. He saw it probably as an opportunity to obtain even more recruits for the Roman army. And that was something that he sorely needed, because at the time he was engaged in a war with the Sasanians in the east. The local Roman Danubian administrators were instructed to allow the Goths to cross the river and to provide the refugees with supplies and assistance. The Danube crossing itself was a frenzied scene, with families scrambling onto makeshift watercraft and swarming across the wide and dangerous river. The refugees were in a pitiful state, They were homeless, scared, and hungry. But they did not receive the aid that they had anticipated from their Roman hosts. Instead, those local Roman administrators greedily viewed this as a chance to enrich themselves. They appropriated much of the food that was intended for the Goths, they sold it themselves for profit, or offered it to the Goths, but at exorbitant prices. The sources are full of appalling stories of corruption and graft. One of these is that the Romans would round up stray dogs and barter these as food to the desperate starving Goths. And the rate they demanded was one Gothic child to be sold into slavery for each dog carcass. The starving Goths naturally began to grow resentful at such treatment. And, fearing an uprising, the Roman administrators apparently decided to nullify this potential threat through the craven ploy of inviting the leading Goths to a banquet and then simply murdering them. Fritigern and the other Gothic chieftains attended this banquet, but they were somehow tipped off about the Roman intentions. A fight broke out, and a number of Romans and Goths were killed. But Fritigern himself managed to escape the trap. He then, understandably, renounced the treaty with Rome and embarked on an open rebellion. The same administrator who had tried to kill Fritigern now pursued him at the head of the local Roman army and attempted to quash this revolt before it could really get going. A pitched battle took place in which the enraged Goths wiped out the Romans. From a Roman perspective, this defeat greatly increased the seriousness of the uprising, since not only did it remove the only military force on the scene that might have served to check the actions of the Goths, but the destitute Goths were now able to equip their men quite nicely with the arms and armor taken off of the slain Romans. Some of the Graefungi took advantage of the Romans' weakness to cross the Danube themselves and join up with the rebels. Fritigern's numbers were further swollen by the addition of other tribes, with some runaway slaves, with disgruntled miners, and even some contingents of Roman deserters. All of these threw in their lot now with the Gothic rebellion. With the Goths now effectively controlling all of Thrace, Valens simply could no longer ignore events. He realized that he would have to cut short his campaign in the east against the Sassanians and bring the core of the Roman army back to deal with Fritigern. Accordingly, he hastily put together a peace treaty with the Sassanians. He sent a message requesting military aid to his nephew, Gratian, and he began to assemble a large force of frontline troops near the capital of Constantinople. All of this, though, took time. So he dispatched one small group ahead to harry the Goths while he organized the main army. There were some inconclusive minor battles, but finally, in 378, Valens was ready to take the field himself. On June 11th, Valens departed Constantinople and marched to the nearby city of Adrianople. The Goths had remained divided, and this was in order to scavenge enough food to survive. But Fritigern, seeing what was happening, now concentrated his forces, and he moved them southward also towards Adrianople. The Roman army probably numbered about 15 to 20,000 experienced men. The Goths were more numerous, although it's impossible to judge how many of them were truly able-bodied warriors. Valens passed by Adrianople and continued westwards, seeking the Goths, and also likely hoping to join up with Gratian and his army, who were marching towards the scene from Italy. Seeing in this an opportunity to cut Valens' supply lines, Fritigern dashed southwards, intending to seize the road behind Valens' army. But Roman scouts detected this movement and so Valens now had to make a crucial choice. The cautious option would have been to wait for Gratian and his reinforcements to arrive, and only then to take on the Goths. Alternatively, he could rush to meet the Goths and attack immediately. Three factors appear to have played into his decision. First of all, he seems to have significantly underestimated the number of Goths that were facing him. Second, he smugly assumed that his professional Roman soldiers would easily be able to beat what he viewed as a mere rabble of barbarians. And third, he was jealous of Gratian's military accomplishments, and likely he was reluctant to share the glory of defeating the Goths with him. It was with Valens in this mood that a letter from Gratian arrived, which urged him to wait until I arrive to share the danger, and do not rashly commit yourself to the risks of a decisive action single-handedly. This admonition may well have had the opposite effect, and perhaps foolishly, Valens chose to attack at once. Even at this late moment, Fritigern was willing to make peace. He sent a priest to Valens with such an offer. But intent on his plan, Valens ignored the entreaty. On August 9th, Valens left his baggage train behind at Adrianople and marched his army towards the Goths. The weather, we know from sources, was blistering hot, and his men had to labor over 8 miles of up and down hilly terrain before finally reaching the site where Fritigern was encamped. In typical fashion, the Goths had drawn up their wagons into a defensive logger, a big circle, on some high ground, and the Gothic women, children, slaves, and animals would all have been protected within this vast circle of wagons, while the Gothic infantry were arrayed in front of it. The Roman cavalry arrived on the scene first, and they set themselves up as a screen behind which the slower-moving infantry could come up and begin to deploy into battle formation facing the Goths. Because the large contingent of Graefungi cavalry had not yet returned from a foraging expedition, Fritigern sent them a message urgently ordering them to come back. He then sought to delay the Romans to give him enough time for those groups to come back by sending envoys to the Romans asking to open negotiations. Here, having decided to fight, Valens should just have done so. But he foolishly allowed himself to be drawn into these negotiations, and a lot of time was wasted. All the while, the parched Roman soldiers continued to bake in the August heat. The Roman cavalry unit, which was posted on the far left of the Roman line, now seems to have disobeyed orders, and they launched a premature attack on the Goths who were opposite them. These cavalrymen were lightly armed scouts, so they should merely have been observing the Goths, or at most maybe skirmish a little with them. But for unknown reasons, they committed themselves to serious combat, and the results were predictable. After initially driving back the Goths immediately facing them, the cavalry scouts were routed by a Gothic counterattack, and the scouts fell back in confusion, disrupting the lines of Romans behind them. One Roman historian notes that their retreat was as cowardly as their advance had been rash. To make matters worse, just as all this was happening, the Graefungi cavalry finally made their appearance on the same side of the field, and they immediately joined in on the attack on the fleeing Roman scouts. Fritigern committed the rest of his troops to a general assault all along the line, and the two sides came crashing together in a back-and-forth hand-to-hand struggle. The Roman historian Ammianus Marcellinus offers a vivid description of the subsequent scene. The opposing lines came into collision like ships of war and pushed each other to and fro, heaving under the reciprocal motion like the waves of the sea. Dust rose in such clouds as to hide the sky, which rang from frightful shouts. In this mutual slaughter, so many were laid low that the field was covered with the bodies of the slain, while the groans of the dying and the severely wounded filled all who heard them with abject fear. Having driven off the cavalry on the Roman left, the Gothic horsemen were now able to strike at this exposed side of the Roman line, which up to that point had been holding firm. Under assault from two directions, the Roman line crumbled, and panic started to spread through the ranks. Valens instructed one of his subordinates to bring up the reserves in order to bolster the line, only to discover that they had already fled. Most of the Roman units joined them in flight, although a few elite divisions did stay and fight it out to the bitter end. Somewhere in all this chaos, Valens was killed. One story says that he was slain outright by an arrow. Another says that he was just wounded by the arrow and was taken to a fortified farmhouse, which became surrounded by Goths. But the Goths didn't know that the emperor was inside, so they set the house on fire, and Valens died in the flames. 35 senior officers and 2/3 of the Roman army also perished on the battlefield, and this made it one of the worst military disasters in all of Roman history. 3 decades after the Battle of Adrianople, another Gothic army under the command of King Alaric would sack the city of Rome itself. And within another 70 years, the Western Roman Empire would fall. While the West soon collapsed, the Eastern Roman Empire would continue for centuries more, eventually becoming known as the Byzantine Empire. More disasters awaited it, however. And 433 years after Adrianople, the Byzantine Empire suffered another devastating defeat that was equally unexpected and complete. The emperor this time around was Nikephoros I, and just like Valens, he was having problems with unwelcome immigrants migrating into the Byzantine Empire. In the late 7th century, a Turkic tribe called the Bulgars had petitioned to cross the Danube and seek refuge within Byzantine territory. The emperor at the time was reluctant to grant this, but the Bulgars entered anyway and were able to seize a large chunk of territory north of Thrace, and there they established the Bulgar Khanate. In 802, the emperor Nikephoros I ascended to the Byzantine throne, and he set for himself the task of recapturing the region occupied by the Bulgars. After some initial raids were successful, Nikephoros assembled a large army in 811 that included both his son and his son-in-law, and then he personally marched off at the head of this massive force to subdue and expel the Bulgars once and for all. The leader of the Bulgars was a man named Krum, who was an experienced warrior. Feeling that he just didn't have sufficient troops to oppose Nikephoros or the time to muster more, Krum made the difficult decision to abandon his capital city, Pliska, and take to the nearby mountains. Nikephoros was able to advance triumphantly into Pliska, massacre the small garrison that Krum had left behind, and looted it. The Byzantines then burned down the city and ravaged the countryside, supposedly even killing the livestock. One source states that Nikephoros planned to erect a new town right on the spot of the ruins, which he would name after himself. Krum made peace overtures. He sent a message to the Roman emperor saying, "You have won. Take what you want and go in peace." But Nikephoros was intent on utterly destroying the Bulgars, and so he refused to even open talks with Krum. Nikephoros set off in pursuit of Krum, who had retreated into the Varbica Pass in the mountains. While Nikephoros had been devastating the capital of Pliska, Krum, meanwhile, had gathered together all his available troops and began to erect defenses in the pass. By this point, Nikephoros arrogantly believed that his foe was already beaten, and so he let discipline among his men slip. He also neglected to properly scout out the pass ahead of him, and he just confidently marched his army right into its narrow confines. Although his officers urged caution, Nikephoros ignored them, and he just shut himself up in his tent. Once deep within the pass, Nikephoros and the Romans found their way blocked by wooden palisades, barriers, and Krum's men lurked along the surrounding hilltops. Rather than attempting to escape back the way they'd come, Nikephoros ordered his army to halt for the night. And then, instead of consolidating his force together like he should have done, all of the contingents just camped where they were, in separate strung-out groups. This was plainly a dangerous situation. But rather than providing the needed leadership, Nikephoros just hid in his tent, refusing even to talk to his own son. Some Byzantine troops, maybe sensing what was coming, took the opportunity to desert and escape the trap that Nikephoros had led them into. Just before dawn, on July 26, Krum launched his attack. He focused his efforts on the imperial encampment containing Nikephoros. Surely the Byzantines must have posted guards, but still the assault seems to have caught the sleeping camp totally by surprise. Rampaging Bulgars broke right in among the tents and slaughtered their inhabitants. As the terrified survivors fled, they incited panic among the other as yet intact contingents of the Byzantine army. And as rumors quickly spread that the emperor was dead, they too broke and ran. Desperate Byzantine soldiers tried to climb up the wooden barriers that were hemming them in, but the Bulgars then set those alight, and many Byzantines were burned alive. Others were hunted down in the woods and killed. Although the fight took place in the mountain pass, it's become known as the Battle of Pliska, and it was the worst disaster for Byzantium since Adrianople. Tens of thousands of men, along with the emperor and much of his court, were all killed. Nikephoros was, indeed, probably slain during the initial assault. His head was cut off and mounted on a pole. His son was paralyzed by a blow, and although his bodyguards managed to carry him from the field, he died of his injuries a few months later. As a final indignity, Krum took Nikephoros' head back to Pliska. He had the skull cleaned out and lined with silver, and then in subsequent years, he used that rather grisly trophy as a drinking cup at banquets. The two battles of Adrianople and Pliska mark distinct stages in the slow decline of the Byzantine Empire, and they share a number of curious similarities. Both of them were defeats triggered by the Romans' failure to deal with immigrant barbarian groups, who might otherwise have been converted into allies. Especially in the case of the Goths, the arrogant and demeaning treatment that they had received at the hands of the Romans sparked their rebellion. Also, in each instance, the overconfidence of the Roman emperor resulted in his making multiple poor tactical decisions. Both emperors rashly led their armies into exposed and dangerous positions that left them vulnerable to attack. And once the attacks began, they failed to provide the leadership that might have saved the situation. The consequences of these actions for both men were defeat and ignominious death. As for their opponents, Fritigern and Krum, neither was able to enjoy for long the fame that they had won, since both died, apparently of natural causes, within 3 years of their respective victories. As psychologically traumatic as these defeats undoubtedly were to the Romans, the empire survived relatively intact, although each reverse may have served to curb further Roman expansion. Pliska was certainly not the end of the Byzantine Empire. its collapse would not come for nearly another 650 years, when Constantinople was besieged and captured by the Ottoman Turks. We'll examine one of the events that precipitated that fall in the next lecture, when we consider some spectacular military disasters that occurred during the time of the Crusades.
Lecture 6, Fourth Crusade, Byzantium Betrayed.
On May 4th, 2001, Pope John Paul II issued an astonishing apology. In a speech directly addressed to the Greek Orthodox Archbishop of Athens, he expressed deep regret for something that had happened a full 800 years earlier. What had prompted such an unusual and belated act of contrition? The answer was the Fourth Crusade, which in the 13th century had gone terribly astray from its professed mission of wresting control of the Holy Lands from their Muslim rulers. Instead, it had brutally and treacherously attacked and looted the city of Constantinople. Constantinople was a supposed ally of the Crusaders, and it was the seat of the Greek Orthodox branch of Christianity. On that day in 2001, John Paul sorrowfully described this event as the disastrous sack of the imperial city of Constantinople, which was, for so long, the bastion of Christianity in the East. It is tragic that the assailants turned against their own brothers in the faith. The diversion of the Fourth Crusade and the sack of Constantinople comprised one of the most shameful episodes of the Crusades, and it was also an event that would have far-reaching consequences upon the entire history of the Mediterranean. The Crusades had begun in 1095 at the Council of Clermont when Pope Urban II had issued a call for volunteers who would embark on an expedition to seize the Holy Lands. And at least from the perspective of Christian medieval Europe, they would liberate the Holy Lands from what was viewed as pagan occupation by the Muslims. Lured by various motives ranging from piety to greed, thousands of knights from all across Europe volunteered to take up the cross. When this formidable army arrived at its target, the local Islamic rulers were taken by surprise. And so the First Crusade was able to achieve its goals in quite spectacular fashion. A number of important cities, including the ultimate prize of Jerusalem itself, were besieged and captured, and several new Crusader kingdoms were carved out in the Holy Lands. The Middle Eastern Caliphate soon counterattacked, and thus began a very long back-and-forth military struggle that would last for several centuries. During this period, the popes would periodically call for further additional crusades to join in on the fighting. But none of these later crusades was nearly as successful as the first one. A turning point in the ongoing war in the Holy Lands occurred in the late 12th century, when the talented Muslim general Saladin was able to consolidate together various Muslim factions, and he won an entire series of stunning victories over the Crusaders. For example, in 1187, he wiped out an entire Crusader army at the Battle of Hattin, and he followed that up by recapturing the city of Jerusalem. These shocking events sparked the Third Crusade. And the Third Crusade got off to a promising start by garnering the participation of Europe's most powerful rulers at the time. And this included the Holy Roman Emperor Frederick Barbarossa. Barbarossa chose to march his contingent to the Holy Lands by land. and this process took nearly a year of travel. But after that time, this mighty host had finally reached the very last stage of its journey. However, while crossing a river in a foolish act of bravado, the extremely elderly Emperor Frederick tried to swim his horse across. Now, accounts differ on exactly what went wrong here. His horse may have slipped, he may have suffered a heart attack, the current might have been too swift, maybe his armor was too heavy. But the result was that he drowned. And without him, the expedition lost its momentum and came to an inconclusive end. In January 1198, an energetic and ambitious new pope was elected in Rome. He was Pope Innocent III, and he was determined to launch a new crusade that would succeed where the preceding ones had failed. In August, he officially issued the proclamation summoning volunteers. A substantial number of eminent knights pledged their participation in what would be known as the Fourth Crusade, and everyone began to plan the expedition. One of the greatest challenges facing crusaders was transportation. And because everyone had the memory of Frederick's disastrous attempt to take the land route fresh in their minds, the leaders of the Fourth Crusade instead decided that they would move their forces primarily by sea. To accomplish this, though, they required a vast fleet of transport ships, as well as warships to protect the armada. Lacking the requisite number of vessels themselves, the leaders naturally turned to the preeminent Christian sea power of the day, which was the city-state of Venice. The Republic of Venice controlled a network of outposts across the Mediterranean, and its merchant ships busily plied among all of these, protected by a large fleet of war galleys. The leader of the Venetian state was Doge Enrico Dandolo, who at the time of the Fourth Crusade was over 90 years old and blind. Despite his infirmities, he was a determined man who worked tirelessly to increase the power of his beloved Venice. When the crusaders appeared seeking Venice's aid, Dandolo negotiated a contract under which Venice agreed to provide appropriate ships to carry 4,500 horses, 4,500 knights, 9,000 squires, and about 20,000 other armed men. In addition, all these men and animals would be fed for 9 months and would be protected by a squadron of 50 first-rate warships. In return for all that, the crusaders promised to pay 85,000 silver marks, and additionally to give to Venice half of whatever plunder they might acquire. That was an enormous sum of money. To give you some idea, it was roughly equivalent to twice the annual income of the wealthy King of France. The Venetians energetically threw themselves into fulfilling their side of the contract. They devoted all Venetian manpower to a veritable frenzy of construction in order to prepare the necessary number of ships. It was no easy matter to transport a horse by sea, let alone several thousand of them. But the clever Venetians fabricated special vessels that were designed to each carry 30 horses suspended in slings, which would prevent their falling over in rough seas and maybe breaking their legs. These ships amounted to medieval versions of amphibious attack vessels because they were built with big doors in their hulls, and they were also designed to be run ashore onto a beach. Inside the hold, the fully equipped knights could mount up on their steeds, and then the doors would be opened, the ramps would be lowered, and they could charge directly into battle on the shore. They were really a lot like the Higgins boats that became famous in World War II. The designated sailing date for the expedition was June 29th, 1202. And by then, the industrious Venetians had their fleet ready. So far, everything seemed to be going well for the Fourth Crusade. However, events were underway that would conspire to derail the expedition and send it on its fateful course. The most important of these was a squabble over succession, which was taking place at the court of the Byzantine emperor in Constantinople. In religious terms, Christianity had split into two branches, with the Pope at Rome being the head of what would become the Catholic Church, while Constantinople was the seat of the Eastern Orthodox Church. The Byzantines, who were very proud of their ancient lineage and glorious cultural heritage, arrogantly viewed themselves as the true leaders of all of Christendom. And they regarded the Western European powers as somewhat uncouth junior partners. The city of Constantinople was a wonder of the age. It was far larger than any city of the time in Europe. It was graced with a plethora of truly awe-inspiring buildings, such as the glorious Church of Hagia Sophia. It was adorned everywhere with fabulous artworks, and it was glutted with centuries' worth of accumulated treasure. On the surface, the Byzantine Empire still appeared to be a potent military and political force. But there was a rottenness at its core. The Byzantine fleet had been neglected for quite a while, and it was now nearly non-existent, while the army was also in decline. But still, Constantinople possessed the most impressive set of defensive walls that you could find anywhere in the Mediterranean basin at the time. And so the Byzantine emperors could sit complacently behind their mighty walls, surrounded in a cocoon of indulgent luxury and participate in elaborate court rituals, and they could just continue to believe themselves to be rulers of the world. Since 1185, the Byzantine emperor had been a man named Isaac II. He was a fairly weak ruler. He was more interested in pleasure and indulgence than in statesmanship. In 1195, he was deposed by a coup in favor of his brother, Alexius. And here I should really note that Byzantine history of this era can get very confusing because of the astonishing coincidence that all three of the people who will lay claim to the throne in the next few years all happen to bear the same name, Alexius. The first of these was the brother of Isaac, and I'll refer to him by his imperial title of Alexius III. All right, upon seizing the throne, this Alexius III ordered that his brother's eyes be gouged out, and then he threw the blinded Isaac, along with his son, into prison. Now, Isaac's son was another Alexius, whom I'll call Prince Alexius. This Prince Alexius was determined to overthrow his uncle, Alexius III, and to take his place on the throne. First, though, of course, he had to escape from prison. He did this by supposedly hiding in a water cask that had a false bottom, and through this daring ruse, was able to sneak out of the prison and flee to Europe. There, he began to travel from court to court, seeking assistance in seizing back the throne that he viewed as rightfully belonging to him. Meanwhile, at Venice, a serious problem had arisen with the Fourth Crusade. Many of the knights who had volunteered for the expedition had chosen to find their own passage to the Holy Lands, with the result that far fewer than the leaders had anticipated showed up at Venice. Since the leaders had been counting on all of the crusaders to contribute to the passage fee, they now had nowhere near to the sum that they had promised the Venetians. Doge Dandolo sternly demanded that the crusaders deliver the balance before sailing. And since they were unable to comply, it looked like the expedition would sputter to an ignominious end before it had even properly gotten going. At this moment of crisis, Dandolo came up with a proposal that he claimed would resolve the impasse. Venice was currently engaged in a dispute with the city of Zadar, which is located on the Dalmatian coast. Venice coveted Zadar because of its strategic location, but the city had given its allegiance to the king of Hungary. Now, Dandolo told the crusaders that if they helped Venice to conquer Zadar, they could postpone payment of the rest of the fee until after the campaign in the Holy Lands had been completed. And at that point, presumably, they would be rich with plunder. In addition, the elderly blind Dandolo said that he himself would join the expedition, along with a sizable force of Venetians. The rather significant catch to this was that the crusaders had sworn an oath to fight Muslims in the east, but now they were contemplating attacking a city of fellow Christians. To make matters worse, the patron of Zadar, the king of Hungary, was himself planning to take up arms against the Muslims. So they would be fighting against a fellow crusader. But desperate to pay off their debt, the leaders disgracefully agreed to Dandolo's proposal. It's really a measure of how craven an act that this was, that they didn't inform the rest of the crusaders about the new target. They merely announced that the expedition was departing. So it was that in October of 1202, the fleet finally set sail, but not for the Holy Lands. Instead, they crossed the Adriatic to Zadar. When the fleet arrived at Zadar, the townspeople displayed crosses on their walls to try to indicate that they too were crusaders. But even this gesture failed to shame the expedition into leaving them alone. The unfortunate city was attacked, captured, and looted. Dandolo had achieved his aim, but others were not so pleased. Pope Innocent III was horrified by the actions of the crusaders. He was so enraged that he took the most extreme measure available to him. He formally excommunicated the crusaders. Many within the crusader army were already fairly unhappy about their actions, and some of them now repented and left. But most of them stayed. But even those were deeply concerned about their excommunication, and they pleaded with the Pope to revoke his sentence. Eventually, Innocent relented, but on the conditions that restitution should be made to the King of Hungary and that the crusaders promise not to attack any more Christians. Most of the crusaders eagerly accepted, but the Venetians ignored the offer, smugly maintaining that they had done nothing wrong at all in the first place. The crusaders settled down to wait out the stormy winter sailing season. But while Venice had profited from the capture of Zadar, the crusaders were still impoverished and unable to pay off their debt. It was at this juncture that a message from Prince Alexius arrived, containing yet another morally troubling proposal. He said that if the crusaders helped to restore him to the throne of the Byzantine Empire, he would pay them 200,000 marks, which would all make the Greek Orthodox Church subservient to the Pope. He also said that he would himself join the now understrength crusade along with 10,000 troops. Once again, the Crusader leaders allowed their desperation to overcome their ethics, and they agreed to Prince Alexius's proposal. They set sail, arriving near Constantinople,